Welcome to The Forum on 90.5 WCBE. The Forum is the Columbus Metro Club's weekly program that cultivates the conversations that drive Columbus forward. Every Wednesday, we bring together bold thinkers and local leaders to dive into the issues shaping our city. Want to join us in person? Tickets and information about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. In an era of media consolidation, shrinking newsrooms, and viral misinformation, the future of trusted journalism is at a crossroads. This week's forum explores the rise of nonprofit and alternative news, the economics of media independence, and asks an urgent question: if journalism is a public good, who pays for it and who gets to shape it? This week's panelists are Philip Bump, author and former national columnist for The Washington Post, Michelle Everhart Sullivan, chief audience officer with Signal Ohio, and Taria Palmer, co-creator of the Columbus Can't Wait podcast. Our host is Mike Thompson, director of radio with WOSU Public Media. Former Washington Post columnist Philip Bump also provides opening remarks. Let's join this week's Columbus Metropolitan Club forum, Who Owns the News? Rebuilding Trust and Local Voices in a Fractured Media Landscape.
The conversation is going to be forward-looking. My experience is more backward-looking. I worked for a newspaper, no offense to those who still work in the newspaper industry, but it is a struggling industry. And so what I wanted to do is take a minute or two just to set context for how we got to the moment that we're in before we start talking about where we're going moving forward. And the place that I like to start when I'm doing that conversation is with a piece that was written in 2009 in the New Republic by a Harvard professor named Lawrence Lessig. And the piece was called Against Transparency. And at the time, the world was still operating under the assumption that providing wide access to the internet and to information online would be democratizing, would mean that people would be better informed, that you could get information about the world anywhere, anytime in your pocket. And Lessig's thesis was no. That wasn't necessarily what was going to happen. What was going to happen was you would provide people enough information that they could cherry pick what it was that they wanted to hear and what it was that they wanted to see. And Lessig, unfortunately, was right. One of the things that we have seen over the course of the past 15 years is precisely that. First, we've seen tools emerge which allow people to do that. We have seen the fragmentation of the media industry, which of course is not all bad. It is good that there are more voices, providing more information about what's happening. The rise of blogs allowed that to happen. The challenge was it very quickly became obvious that there was a market incentive to provide information to people that they already wanted to hear, that there was a market for bias, and that there were lots of people who were happy to fill that market. And then social media made it worse, made that particular effect worse. Social media, of course, again, has benefits. But it made it very easy for people to stand up their own argumentation platforms, to be themselves and making cases that they wanted to make that weren't necessarily rooted in reality. One of the things that the internet has taught us, I like to use this example, it's a little bizarre, but that 30 years ago, there were people who liked to dress like animals, right? And that was what they did for fun. And then the internet happened, and they discovered there are whole communities of people like to do that called furries. Now they have conventions of furries in Pittsburgh, where my sister's from. She doesn't go to them. But like this is a thing now because the internet taught everyone, oh, look, there are other people that share this interest. And that was a positive benefit. But it also means that you can very easily build communities around things that aren't true and around presentations of the world that are not factual, and that those things have a lot of appeal relative to those who are saying, here's what's actually happening, these are the hard realities. So this is the position in which we find ourselves. And the challenge is, I'm going to say that despite this conversation, and maybe something will emerge here that changes my mind, but I don't think anyone knows the solution to that problem. I don't think anyone knows how it is that we reestablish institutions in which people will have trust and in which people will want to invest trust. Right? We have immersed ourselves so fully in a universe where you can hear anything that you want to hear, and we seize upon the things that we want to hear so readily that it's hard to imagine how we rebuild something that challenges people in that way. What I do hope will come out of this conversation, and what I hope will come out of the broader conversation, is a recognition that we are just at a nadir, that we are at a low point. That we are now starting to see this is as bad as it gets, and we're going to rebuild new systems. Because look, we all recognize the media landscape has changed, right? We have moved from institutions to individuals. We have moved from placing trust in those who go out and hold themselves accountable to those who say what it is that we want to hear. We've seen these changes take place, and they're not going away. But we are also seeing, particularly from organizations like those of my colleagues here, are green shoots of new growth in the media industry. The problem that we have right now in 2025 is We also need big, sturdy oaks, and not just green shoots, things that we can rely on, institutions, powerful institutions, that can provide reality and accuracy to the world. I am speaking to you now as a former Washington Post columnist. I took a buyout from the Washington Post earlier this year for reasons that are not going to surprise any of you in this room, right? Like, we have seen as well that a lot of the sturdy oaks that we thought were sturdy aren't that sturdy. And that's one of the challenges as well. So this is the situation in which we find ourselves. My co-panelists here are doing fantastic work in challenging and thinking through what that looks like. But again, we don't necessarily know, and hopefully this conversation can help all of us have a better sense of what we need to invest in to make that happen.
Well, thanks for all for joining us, and we'll get right into it. We'll talk about the trust issue first. There's a new Gallup poll. I think it came out yesterday or the day before that shows that 28% of the American public, it's down a tick, down from 30 or 31, 28% of the American public have at least or only a fair amount of trust in the media. So let me ask you, Philip, why do you believe that number and why do you think that is?
Boy, do I believe that number. Is my mic? Yes. Yes, that number is undoubtedly accurate. And I think there are two reasons. The first is that trust in institutions broadly has declined over time. My last piece that I wrote for The Post actually was sort of a tacit challenge to the owner of The Washington Post, but was looking at the extent to which confidence in institutions has eroded and the ways in which that opened the door for people to help erode democracy, not naming names. So this is a longstanding pattern, but media in particular as an institution that exists to tell the truth in a moment where the truth itself is labeled as biased and partisan, the media has a much more difficult challenge in building and retaining trust than do other institutions. So it's part of a long-term trend both with institutions and with the media, but it's particularly acute at this moment because of the role that the media plays.
That poll found that 8% of Republicans trust the news, 51% of Democrats trust the news media, independents are at the average 27%. So that shows you what you're saying, is that the facts have become political.
Right, and you know, there's lots of data out there assessing the extent to which individual news organizations and news purveyors are trusted. I was looking at numbers last night in preparation for this, and nationally, there are more people who have trust in Joe Rogan than in Axios. Right, which people may not have heard of. That's part of the issue. A lot of people haven't heard of Axios, but Joe Rogan is not someone who predicates his offerings on ensuring accuracy in reality, but he does what he does is compelling. And there are lots of media outlets that are compelling to people who don't necessarily want to be challenged with the hard realities of what's happening, and there is an audience for it, and there are market forces behind that, and that's part of the issue.
Michelle, local news does a little better. 40% say they trust local news. Why do you think that is? Is it because they know who's covering them, or they have a better way of verifying the facts that are reported in their local outlet?
I think that definitely has a big factor in it. We on the local level can go out and meet people. We walk the neighborhoods. We're at your city council meetings. We're at the state house. So you get to know us. That doesn't always mean that you're going to trust us, but if we put in that time, if we put in that work, we're your neighbors. We're at the soccer fields with you and your kids. So I do believe that helps build that trust. And that's what a lot of I see local news organizations doing, getting out there, having the panels, being there in the community so people get to know them and trust them.
Tria, is the term media too broad? You know, you think about media, back in the day, it was CBS, NBC, ABC, the New York Times, the Columbus Dispatch, your local radio stations. Is the media, now you have Axios, you have all these outlets that don't always have the same cachet, standards, history, background. Is the term media too broad?
I never really thought about that question, but I think you could make a case for that. I think that if you mentioned Joe Rogan, should we be considering someone like that who doesn't have to go through the same kind of rigorous standards or isn't necessarily like a quote unquote trained journalist? Like, I went to Ohio University, and so we have one of the best journalism schools in the country. I did not graduate, but there's somebody on I did not graduate from the journalism school, but there's somebody on our staff who did, right? So we have like some standards, and even though we're a small news outlet. So I think that there's a case to say that maybe the term, maybe there should be some different terms or different buckets for the work that folks are doing.
I would also note that one of the reasons I think that local news is advantaged in this sort of assessment is that local news is able to stay out of the nationalized aspect of the media, right? National media can't do that. Local news has the ability to, even though everything that is occurring ends up sifting to a partisan frame for the most part. It is, however, the case that local news is able to stay outside of the broader national conversation on which everyone is fixated, which I think is advantageous.
Getting back to what you said about how there was hope that when this media, you know, environment expanded, that there would be more information, be more civic engagement. Instead, it's more siloed. Why do you think there had, let's look at the case of Fox News, when they first went on cable. There was obviously an audience for that that was not being served by CNN at the time, was the other cable news outlet, or the three major networks. Did those networks fail to serve that audience, which gave birth to Fox, which eventually evolved into what it is today?
Yeah, I mean, the history of Fox News is long and more mottled than I think people necessarily recognize. Fox News was initiated as a project, as a political project, essentially, as an offshoot of a decades-long effort by the political right to pillory the mainstream media, which was not necessarily being helpful to them. I think that is a broad thing to say, but I think that it's fair to say. Fox News has changed since then. I think it has become much more partisan in the way that it does what it does. I think they encountered this really, really stark challenge when Donald Trump arose because they had this shared base of people that listened to them. And Fox found that its audience listened to Trump more than it listened to them because he was giving them even more of what Fox News would be giving them. I remain convinced to this day that the reason Donald Trump was elected president, the reason he won the nomination in 2016, is not because he was a genius politician. It was because he was saying the things from the right-wing fringe that they were hearing on Breitbart and they were hearing on social media, and they were saying that's where he got the reputation as a truth teller. He's telling the truth because he's saying those things back to them. I think he's a product of that media space, and I think Fox News found themselves flat-footed, particularly after 2020, when they knew that he didn't win the election. But they very quickly learned they couldn't say that. And so Donald Trump is a product of this and also an accelerant of it. And I think Fox News is a very good example of how that shift has occurred.
Michelle, the role of social media, I mean, that between, not just away from the algorithms, I mean, you choose to follow who you follow, and it just, as Philip said, it reinforces what you already know. Is there any way to undo that, to make social media less siloed?
I mean, it is an echo chamber. It depends on who you follow. You're going to, if you're following people that you believe in, you're only going to hear those beliefs. So it's, I think it's up to us to diversify who we're following, partly. I think it's also up to news organizations to build that trust so that they can get people to follow. And whether they always agree with what's happening or not, if we can build that trust and get them in and show them different viewpoints, maybe we make a difference.
I also don't know if like the onus is fully on us, like the people who own the social media platforms, who create these algorithms that create these echo chambers, are really at fault here. And so I know our show is all about like people power. Like, people really need to be putting pressure on these companies to stop creating these algorithms that allow people to live in like an alternate reality where, you know, if you're not pushing yourself to watch something like even BBC or like some of the other news organizations that people don't necessarily always think about, like that are not just United States focused, then you can find yourself in that. So I think the onus is on these, you know, billion-dollar companies as well to do better.
There are companies out there, the Blue Sky, who is just trying to compete against now X. I don't know how, I haven't looked at X's subscriber numbers recently, or follower numbers, but it could be. I mean, look at Jimmy Kimmel. He's back on the air because everyone's canceled their Disney Plus subscription. Let's face it, it came down to dollars. You know?
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Like, people, we have the power to really change some of these things. We are the numbers. And you mentioned Blue Sky. Blue Sky came out of the fact that X was bought by, you know, Elon Musk and changed from what it you know, I'm a millennial, and Twitter was something different than what X became. And so, you know, I think that a platform like Blue Sky and that kind of model and how folks have done that should be what we are looking to kind of take some of that back.
I would just note that I think that's exactly right. I would just note that we cannot underestimate the market force here, and I mentioned that briefly, but there is demand for people hearing what it is they want to hear. That's fundamentally the problem. And, you know, it used to be the case that, you know, I hate to invoke Walter Cronkite because it's so hoary and tedious, but like Walter Cronkite would get on and this was the news and everyone would see it. And if you didn't agree with it, you were supportive of the Vietnam War or whatever it happened to be. Well, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but tough, right? Like this is the news. This is what's going on in the world. And you were not spoon fed the thing that you wanted to hear, because there just wasn't an ability to do that, right? And I'm not saying that was perfect in any stretch, and I'm not saying it was unbiased in any stretch, but it was the case that if you disagreed, you at least had to hear a different perspective. The market that exists right now is it is so easy to just make it so you don't have to hear that. And this is true on the left and the right. A lot of people on the left are like, oh, yeah, Fox News. It happens on the left, too. I get a lot of feedback from people on the left who are like, how can you say X? Why aren't you trying to support, you know, Biden? It's like, well, because I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm trying to, like, my job is to tell the truth. And until people break that habit of feeling like they only need to hear things that they want to hear, I think it's hard to fix any of these.
Yeah, 95% of my complaints at WOSU come from liberals who complain that we are not liberal enough. And how can you put that Republican guy on the air? I don't want to hear him. If I wanted to hear him, I would turn to Fox News. And I have a form letter already to when I have a conservative panelist on my show, I just say thanks for the things. Here's why he's on, because...
Although I would suspect that part of the reason the imbalance is so heavily liberal is because you don't have a lot of conservatives.
Yeah, but, you know, it's also the same thing. They don't want to hear the other side. They don't want to. And my argument is that 35% of your community, your neighbors, agree with this person. Right. If we're going to move this conversation forward, you got to hear from them. Let's talk about breaking through with all of the choices out there. Tariya, there are 4.5 million podcasts around the world. 4.5 million. Seems like it could be almost more. It seems like a low number, given the number of billions of people on the planet. But anyway, you're a podcaster. How do you gain eardrums, or now eyeballs, because you're on YouTube as well?
I mean, I think that's kind of how we did it. We started out in my house, and we just had 2 podcast mics, and we thought that there was kind of a gap in the perspective, particularly like young Black folks' perspective about things that were happening in Columbus around politics and community. And so we started the show, and then I think we did break through. We had started to gain like a smaller listener base, and then once we got on YouTube, if anyone knows anything about social media, like video is the key. And once we started posting videos and going to have like a studio kind of produced podcast, that's when our audience really started to grow. And we have a small but mighty audience of people that are locked in and listen to us talk about local, hyper-local politics and hyper-local community, things that aren't like sexy, but are things that like you need to know to be engaged in community. So I'd say like the video piece was really big to us being able to break through, as you said.
Michelle, you are living this right now. You're in a startup, relatively new startup, just a few years old, Signal, bureaus in Cleveland and Akron, correct? And now State House and working in Cincinnati. How are you trying to gain folks to listen to you, read you, get your newsletters, things like that?
We always talk about meeting people where they are. So that's on the different platforms. That's in coffee shops, that's in the library, that's meeting them where they are. Our newsletters are really engaging and where we see the most of our donations come through because people enjoy them. We're also listening to people. We do a lot of surveys. We have documenters where we train and pay people to go to public meetings and to write notes from that. So that's, you know, a way for us to expand our coverage. But it's also...
Explain that, because that's a really novel concept.
Sure.
These are basically... We used to call them freelancers.
Yes.
But they're not,
They're not freelancers. Okay. They are just people, they may not even have a journalism background. They're people who want to be civically engaged. So it is for them to go to Cleveland City Hall, sit through a meeting, take the notes, and then we turn those into briefs, or we may take it to a reporter who is a trained journalist and have them do a little bit more reporting on it. We have over 1,000 people throughout Ohio trained now to do that. And not only are they, we call it a civic side hustle, but they're also our evangelists. So they're out talking about us, and we activate them during our membership campaigns. We activate them when we're doing stories in their neighborhoods and asking them to share it. And we've been talking a lot about, okay, what is another way of doing this? Is there a connector? Like, maybe you don't want to go to the public meetings, but is there a way that we can reach out to people who are willing to share our information in their neighborhood Facebook groups? Because again, that's where people are getting their information. They're getting it on Nextdoor. They're getting their news on YouTube. So how do we start reaching into those areas and finding ambassadors who can help us do that?
I want to lift up a common thread from both of those success stories, which is that part of the benefit of having the internet do what the internet does is you are able to find these niche audiences, right? Like, I use the furry example because you remember it, right? But this is what I'm talking about, that there are people, like, Ohioans want to know what's happening. There's a lot of them. People who want to know what's happening, particularly young black people in Columbus, want to know what's happening in the community. There is that niche that exists and that you can appeal to, right? When I was at the Washington Post, I had a newsletter, and it was about charts, about data visualization, had 100,000 people subscribe to it, right? Like, there is a niche for a lot of these things, and if you think about it, like, what's the New York Times. The New York Times was the local newspaper in New York City, and then it became huge. It became a behemoth, right? Like, these are the kind of green shoots that I'm talking about, right? Like, these are the sorts of things that can build and build and build, and maybe you expand, you know, into all of Ohio and all of the Midwest, and, you know, like, there are all these ways in which if you have these things out there and you build that trust and you invest in it, there are people who will aggregate around it, and I think that's one of the bright spots I see for the media.
One of the things that, you know, as you read newspapers and you read local newspapers, you can see that they are, one of the metrics that they use, that they probably send off to advertisers, is clicks. What is the benefit of measuring clicks, and what is the danger of measuring clicks on a story?
This is probably bad for me to admit, but I don't pay attention to any of that. Part of the reason is because I don't have to. We're volunteer-led. We exist because of like crowdfunding and people like writing us checks to do this work. And so I don't really have to worry about clicks or saying things or doing things that are sensationalized to get views. And so for me, I find a lot of solace in that, because I think that that's kind of how we've gotten to this slippery slope of people sensationalizing the news versus just like telling the news how it is. Or like, we have politicians on, we have organizers on, and we, you know, provide a platform for people, but we're not necessarily like handcuffed to our views. And we were very clear about, you know, social media is democratized. You can get on for free. However, we can do this with as least resources as possible. Let's do it, because we didn't want that piece of like the clicks and the views to be why we were like doing this work.
Michelle, how important are clicks to your work?
I consider the metrics, and I live in the metrics with my job and have for many, many years. It's more of a salad bar. Like, we don't look at, like, I'm not just going for clicks. I don't want just lettuce. I want the carrots. I want the unique visitors. I want the time on site. But it's more than just the metrics of website. It is, are we getting a lot of shares on Instagram? So we're reaching a wider audience that may not know us. Are we having an impact where City Hall changed something because we pointed out there was a problem? Are we, and we've seen this a number of times in Akron, where we've profiled what a nonprofit is doing, some great work, are they seeing an increase in donations because of what we've done? So it's not just page views for us. It is a wide variety of impacts that we can share with our readers, with potential funders, with advertisers, to show the work that we're doing.
Philip, when you look at a newspaper, what they present, you cover City Hall, you cover state government, but you also cover a local restaurant closing. Which gets more clicks?
There are other people in this room who are better at answering that question than myself. I worked for the Washington Post, but I was in New York the whole time. So like, yeah. People are always like, do you know so-and-so from the Post? I'm like, no, I don't. You know, God bless them. Anyway, I don't know the answer to that question. I can say that my gut is, and my gut always is on this issue, that if you yourself think something is interesting, then lots of people will think it's interesting. And so I think that a lot of people would probably find this thing that happened to them locally interesting. You know, newspapers were always, or have long been, an aggregation not just of news, but of other things that keep people interested, right? Like classified ads, I gotta buy a new couch. There's cartoons, or, you know, comic strips, there's puzzles, there's the horoscopes for some reason, right? Like, there are all these things that exist in, no offense, there are all these things that exist in a newspaper that are there because it's supposed to be a whole product that has lots of things that are appealing to people, right? And so I think a lot of newspapers were sort of slow to figure out that you had to recreate that using tools that weren't things that were on the printed page. And you had to recreate it by doing more videos, and you had to recreate it by doing more interactive things and things along those lines. But I think that's still the mantra, and I think it is still the case that, you know, a lot of people subscribe to the New York Times. The New York Times today, the reason the Washington Post is suffering and the New York Times is thriving is because the New York Times made a very good bet in the aftermath of the late Trump first administration era and the Biden administration of investing in food and games and all these other things that weren't the core news product, which they're very good at, and the New York Washington Post is still very good at. But they made this thing other reasons for people to have this subscription, right? And so those things are the things that sell, and then you also are like, and here's your news on the side. Of course, there are people that buy the news as well, but this is why.
Well, I mean, the joke is that the New York Times is Wordle with a little bit of news. Because that's what's paying the bills is the yeah. Wordle subscription.
Yeah, my sister and I do the Wordle every day, and we regularly talk about Times articles that I can recall.
Yeah. let's get to the ownership of the media. I mean, it's consolidation. We see it. We've seen it nationally for a long time, but now even more locally, corporate ownership of media is that a good thing? I mean, it's not all bad, is it? I mean. Because corporate ownership has resources, efficiencies of scale. You, in theory, you should be able to consolidate the back end. You have the same, have one accounting firm, one, and then have more reporters on the streets. But that has not happened in all cases.
I feel as though I should answer this. Look, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post from the Graham family in 2013. I started there in 2014. And for the first 8 years, 9 years that Jeff Bezos owned the newspaper as a godsend, right? Because he had, you know, more money than he knew what to do with. He was investing and he was hiring all those people. I came in as a function of him expanding the size of the newspaper. And, you know, it seemed as though, and, you know, he was willing to stand up to the power. Like the mantra of journalism is speak truth to power. It is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. That's your job as a journalist. And Jeff Bezos was there fighting that fight. And then something happened. And it's, you know, there are going to be books written in the future about what that thing is. But this is always the case when you have something that is at the whim of an individual, is that the individual's whim can change. And that holds for corporate entities as well, I think. And the challenge, of course, is that very wealthy individuals and corporate entities have a lot more money and can do these things. And, you know, it is very hard to stand up something new. It's very hard to have to do fundraising. Unfortunately, it's, you know, I there have been a lot of efforts to find some middle ground between those two, and I don't know anyone's found one yet.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week's forum explores how nonprofit and alternative news outlets are rebuilding trust and amplifying local voices in a fractured media landscape. This week's panelists are Philip Bump, author and former national columnist with The Washington Post, Michelle Everhart Sullivan, chief audience officer with Signal Ohio, and Taria Palmer, co-creator of the Columbus Can't Wait podcast. Our host is Mike Thompson, director of radio at WOSU Public Media. We'll return to this week's CMC Forum, Who Owns the News? Rebuilding Trust and Local Voices in a Fractured Media Landscape, after a short break.
Do you love amazing stories? I know I do. I'm Michael Kent, and every week on my show, we examine something from history that's so unbelievable it sounds made up, but is 100% verifiably true. It's a podcast called The Internet Says It's True, and there are hundreds of episodes to choose from. For example, did you know the story of how Leonard Nimoy came up with Live Long and Prosper for Star Trek? Or how Columbia is dealing with a hippo problem that goes back directly to Pablo Escobar? Or one of my favorite stories, a man figured out that a nondescript Winnebago being auctioned online was actually an important part of space exploration history. These are all stories from The Internet Says It's True. Listening to a podcast has never been easier. You can listen through any popular podcast app, through the NPR app, or download the fantastic new WCBE app, click the Podcasts tab, and look for The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent. You'll have so many stories up your sleeve, you'll feel like the smartest person in the room, especially if you're home alone.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. In an era of media consolidation, shrinking newsrooms, and viral misinformation, the future of trusted journalism is at a crossroads. This week's forum explores the rise of nonprofit and alternative news, the economics of media independence, and asks an urgent question: if journalism is a public good, who pays for it, and who gets to shape it? This week's panelists are Philip Bump, author and former national columnist with The Washington Post, Michelle Everhart Sullivan, chief audience officer with Signal Ohio, and Taria Palmer, co-creator of the Columbus Can't Wait podcast. Our host is Mike Thompson, director of radio at WOSU Public Media. Let's get back to this week's CMC Forum, Who Owns the News? Rebuilding Trust and Local Voices in a Fractured Media Landscape.
We sort of look at the past with rose-colored glasses, and I've lived in cities where the newspaper was locally owned, but that wasn't always a good thing. The newspaper had a political agenda and would report things that aided that political agenda. So corporate influence is just influence in a different form, right, Michelle?
Yes. Whoever's the owner gets to influence that. So
they have the ink.
Yeah, there are definitely good and bad things about the corporate ownership. You do get more resources. You do get a team that you can, bounce things off of. Somebody in Texas, did this work for you or not? You get more training. There are some really great things that happen because of that corporate ownership. There are takeaways, too, that you have to kind of deal with as well.
How do you... You said it's a volunteer thing, your podcast. Do you try to sell advertising or try to get donations?
Well, yes, we do try to get donations, but we use a crowdfunding sort of, like the community funds our show, basically. We're funded by our neighbors. We're funded by people that believe in the work that we do and not by, corporate interests. I know that, I have a background in fundraising, so I know, where the money is, but I also know what happens sometimes when you take money and the things that you can't say, the way that, maybe having a 501c3 structure or C4 structure means you can't comment on certain things in a certain way. And because our show was focused essentially on like community and politics, I was very not wanting to kind of go down those kind of roads because I didn't want to be, again, handcuffed by what we could and could not say. And so we just rely on the community to support us and our listeners to support us. That might be Patreon. We had that for a while, but we've also done work through other platforms. And so that's how we, sustain our work and the folks that volunteer and, provide studio time for us. So we're very community-driven and community-led.
Yeah. Having worked in nonprofit news for more than 20 years, and that was during the boom time of for-profit news and newspapers, and now welcome to our world. Welcome to the nonprofit world, even if you are a for-profit company. Is nonprofit the way to go, Michelle? Is that Philip talking about how do we get out of this? Is nonprofit the way to go for a news organization to get that trust restored and to maintain independence?
I think it's a piece of the puzzle. I think there's more than enough for any newsroom to cover in any city. So I think there are different business models that can have different missions and different ways of doing things. It doesn't have to be just one way or the other. We have found, with nonprofit, we're free. We don't have a paywall. But in the beginning, we probably leaned in too hard saying we're free. Because everybody's like, well, then I don't have to pay. I don't have to donate. And so we've kind of switched it around to say, we're free, we don't have a paywall, yes, but somebody has to pay for this.
Have you thought about mugs, giving away mugs? No?
Yes. Merch for sure is the way.
So it's some of it, it's in the messaging to people about, yeah, you can access for free, but help your neighbors access it by giving us $5, by giving us $50, whatever you can do.
I think there's an aspect of this that is more salient now than it has been probably at any other point in American history, which is that, you know, when I was speaking earlier about green shoots and you know these oaks, that institutions like the New York Times and the Washington Post built power, built institutional power over time. They invested in themselves and established things that were bulwarks, right, that were strong and that could push back on pressure. And one of the things that was advantageous of working in the Washington Post is when someone threatened my life, which happened not infrequently, I could turn over to the Post security team. They had people to deal with that. And when we got sued, they had lawyers to deal with that. One of the things that is challenging now for media entities is there is a very quick willingness to sue and to say, you wrote something I don't like, I am taking you to court, and even if I don't win, I'm going to cost you so much money that you're going to be absolutely obliterated. And that is a strategy that has been increasing, and we're seeing that now coming from the federal government as well. And you know, if you had said to me 1 year ago today, this is what's coming, I would have said, well, yeah, but the Washington Post will fight back on that, right? I assume CBS will fight back on that, right? And that didn't happen. And that has been one of the most astonishing things I've seen over the course of the past 8 months. But it is important to recognize that while we are figuring out how to, you know, pay the basic bills of doing journalism, there looms over it this financial threat that exists from people who don't like critical coverage that I think is unique at this moment in time.
So, Tria, you work in fundraising. Are there people out there, are there large donors, wealthy donors, who are willing to pay for nonprofit news and step back and let them do their work without influence?
Yeah, I think they're out there. If you asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said I don't think people were really thinking that was something they needed to do. But now with the rise in misinformation and disinformation, the rise in, you know, people being radicalized in ways that have caused violence in our communities, I think that folks are thinking about what ways can they support and step back with providing that support. So I'd say that they're out there, and it's definitely risen over the last probably 3 to 4 years.
All right, we want to open it up to questions, as is CMC's tradition. So if you have a question, please make your way to the microphone where Doug Buchanan is back there. And also, if you're joining us on YouTube, please type your questions into the chat. But before we take audience questions, one final question. We talk about a lot of this through the Trump lens. He's got 3 years left in office. He will not live forever. We all will pass away at some point. Is this just a temporary situation? Or is this a permanent trend we're on? Because everything now is just so bizarre and so dependent on him. I don't see anybody picking up the mantle from him when he goes off to the golf course and just focuses on that.
Yeah, I think there's two different questions embedded in that. The first question is the extent to which Donald Trump drives a significant portion of how many Americans act. And I think it is undeniable that he has an influence that others don't share that will erode once he is no longer on the scene. I think that's true. Although, on the other hand, the other aspect of that is what is happening to people's confidence in institutions and in the media. And as I noted at the outset, that preceded Donald Trump. Donald Trump leveraged that. He piggybacked on top of that distrust, on top of the willingness of an increasing percentage of Americans to say, you know what? I don't care what the New York Times says. I'm listening to Breitbart, right? And they were saying things that weren't true. And that challenge existed before Donald Trump. That challenge is fundamental to what's happening with the media. It's just exacerbated by Trump in the moment. And once Trump is no longer there anymore, that will remain.
All right, Doug Buchanan's curating questions, both from YouTube and from here. I'll turn it over to you, Doug.
Mike, thank you very much, and thank you so much to today's panelists. If you have a question for today's panelists, please do join us here at the microphone. We'll try to get to as many questions as we can. As Mike mentioned, if you're watching online, please type your questions in the chat. We'll try to get to as many of those as we can. Great questions at CMC always have two things in common. They take about 30 seconds or less to ask. And what punctuation mark should a question end with? They end with a question mark. Yes, they do. Thank you, everybody. I'll launch us off with this one. Is journalism a public good? if journalism is not a public good, what implication does that have for how it should be funded?
I wouldn't say it's a public good just because I think that's sort of arcane and doesn't really mean a lot in practical terms. I would say journalism is important. I think it's important both for people to understand what's actually happening in the world, but secondarily for people who have power to be held to account. And so I think that is good for the public. Is it a public good? If you want to call it a public good, sure, but I think those things are important.
You're getting at, should the government fund journalism? As they fund other public goods.
Sure. I mean, if that's an explicit question, then I think that's a massive landmine. Canada's trying to experiment with it, which I'm not sure how that's going to go. But I think it introduces a whole range of problems and doesn't necessarily solve any of them.
Now, would we want this government funding? I would not want this government funding our journalism. So my answer to that is just flat out no.
Well, Michelle, I listen to the BBC, and I'll honestly say the BBC does the best job of getting right down the middle. And that's government funded.
I think it's important. If you have established it, if you've got the workflow in place, if you've got the guardrails up where it works for the BBC, great. Mm-hmm. Do I think it could work at this time in America?
Oh.
Probably not.
I'm not sure what could work at this time in America.
I mean, I'll just note the BBC too. Culturally, the BBC is embedded in a way that, for example, PBS wasn't, right? And so PBS, and also we are further along the path than is the United Kingdom.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, David Williams, retired. I began my career as a radio and television reporter, and later I went on to work as the chief of staff and communications director for three members of Congress. I'm going to lay out a prescription for what I think needs to happen for things to change, and then ask for your reaction. I believe what is necessary is that the people who are promulgating the lies and the people who are consuming those lies need to be defeated politically, decisively, so that people understand they can no longer benefit from telling the lies, and that people who are consuming those lies may think differently. What do you think?
I think that if you had said that on November 3rd, 2016, I would have agreed with you.
I mean, what's changed?
What's changed is Donald Trump won election, Donald Trump won re-election. It's been very clear. Donald Trump lies all the time. Like when we talk about the people who are leading lies in American conversation, Donald Trump is at the forefront of that. And the fact that he got re-elected by the Americans in 2024 indicates that that strategy, while obviously politics is the way to address politicians that you disagree with, that did not work in terms of holding him to account for his lies. And in fact, he is more empowered now than he was even before it happened. I mean, this is a president who stoked violence at the Capitol on January 6th, 2021, and he won re-election to the presidency 3 years later. So, like, yes, ideally, this is how democracy works, but I think we have already seen two very direct examples of how that sort of accountability simply isn't going to be enough.
Thank you. Retired journalist Carol Looper, watching online, wants to know, this is a good one, how do we know what and who to believe?
I think you, for newsrooms, that is on us to build that trust, but it's also on you to do the research, to actually look at different viewpoints that you may or may not agree with. It's hard right now. We were talking about it at lunch, like AI. We could do, I don't know how many panels on trying to figure out AI. So it's very difficult right now to do that, but it takes time. And for us as journalists, it is getting out there, talking to people, being part of the community, and showing up.
Yeah.
The trust in journalism, trying to figure out what's real and what's not, to the early days of Wikipedia, if you all remember that. Wikipedia came on board, it was an encyclopedia, there were quite a few errors, and nobody trusted it. I remember in our newsroom, we're not using Wikipedia unless you've independently fact what you found there. No, studies have shown that it is very accurate. And one of the reasons it's accurate is because of crowdsourced fact-checking. So when you see that AI image on Facebook or on Instagram, if they've allowed comments, people will say, this is crap, or this is not true. What's the role of that in building trust in what we hear and in knowing what's fact and what's fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I think even it happens in our comments. Like, we've had folks come on our show and tell and say something that is not true, and people will get in the comments and say, I was there, or that's not how that happened, or that is not the truth. And so I think we've also built kind of a community where people will fact check one another. And I think that that's really important, especially when you're in a small newsroom and, you know, you don't have a lot of staff, that people will kind of take it upon themselves to come in the comments or to send an email. Sometimes it's a nasty email, but I appreciate it because then, you know, we have a chance to correct the record.
And the through line here is accountability. And, you know, I'll say something that's not particularly generous to a lot of people out there in the world, but there's somehow been this complete erosion of maturity in the United States, and just people unwilling to be like, you know what, this is kind of painful for me. I mean, look, we've worked as reporters, and the hardest thing you have to do is write a correction for something, right? Like, it sucks, like, to put something out there and get it wrong, and then have to be like, I was wrong, and here's why. It's the worst, but it's accountability, and it's part of the institution that forces you to do that. And we have gotten away not only from that in the media with people like Joe Rogan, who just say stuff that's false, and they're kind of like, nah, and they don't really care, and people listen anyway, but personally, right? Like, Wikipedia is about accountability. You have all these editors that work together and they hold each other to account and they take things down, but we need to be accountable to ourselves. Just be like, you know what? I do like reading this, but I should really read this. And just be adults and just, like, treat the media as something, treat news and information as something that we are bound to pay attention to as a function of our being adults and being members of a democratic society, and instead of just sitting there and flipping through Instagram reels being like, oh, that's funny. Like, we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our society to do more to hold ourselves to account.
Please.
Hi there. Lisa Rontala, the investigative reporter for ABC6. Thank you. I've been enjoying the conversation. And I came up here to ask about AI. How does AI evolve in the newsroom in the future? What are the guardrails that should be followed when it comes to AI? What does AI do to trust for viewers and for readers out there? And in newsrooms that are getting smaller and smaller, what does AI mean for the job of a journalist, and how many jobs will there be for journalists in the future?
Do you use AI at Signal?
We do. We are working on an AI policy that will be both internal and forward-facing to let everybody know what we use AI for and what we don't use it for. When we do use it, we want to be very transparent about it. I use it in ways to analyze data, but anything that we do is double-checked. It is not just, okay, this is right, let me go about it and publish it. So anything that we use, I'm not a big fan of AI for images, especially like really real-life images, like I would graphics maybe. As far as, there were a lot of questions there, how many jobs are there for journalists left? I hope that... there's still plenty of jobs, right? We're shrinking, but there's still plenty of work to do. And if we are doing the human connection, if we're doing the panels, if we're going to the coffee shops, if we're going to the libraries, if we're meeting people where they are, there's still jobs for us, and we're building that connection. I think journalists really need to be more connectors and conveners. I think that may be an area where we can grow, where we can have these kind of discussions, where we can have town halls, where we can bring people together. So it's not just a one-way conversation where we put a headline out and you read it. It's more, it's not transactional. It's more of us having that community and working together.
I just want to say a couple quick things about AI. The first is that AI is at this point good at things that computers are good at, not good at things that humans are good at. It's good at doing parsing data. Some of it, Claude is better than ChatGPT, for example, at parsing data, extracting data. It is good at doing, you know, rudimentary code, things like that. It's good that we should differentiate between that use of AI and what's generally called the AI slop, which is, you know, these crummy images and videos and all this stupid garbage that you see out there, and that, you know, Facebook is leaning into and so on and so forth. I think it's important to recognize too that there are two sides to that being a problem, both of which we've seen in national politics, which is not only do you have fake images portraying something that didn't actually occur, but you have it being used as an excuse to wave away things that did actually occur, right? You have people pointing to, like, Donald Trump at one point in time said that the Access Hollywood tape was, you know, maybe that was done by computers, right? Which is just nonsense because he'd already admitted that he'd already done it. But, you know, like, this is the excuse. Because you have all this fakeness out there, it's easy to say that things are fake. I wrote a piece for my personal blog about this a couple months ago about this blurring of reality. And it's not just AI. It's also things like The fact that in a moment earlier this year, there's a guy who dressed as a police officer and murdered a legislator in Minnesota, as law enforcement were hiding their identities and seizing people off the streets. And it's like, well, who's a real cop and who isn't? Who's enforcing the law and who isn't? It's hard to tell what's real and what isn't, even offline, right? Like, this is the environment in which we live. And I think AI absolutely contributes to that, even though it does have some good use cases.
I just think the way that journalism can help with this is to report on it, right? To talk about the dangers of AI, to talk about obviously like the good pieces of it. But I think particularly for marginalized communities, I worry about AI and the actual things that we're experiencing in our everyday lives being seen as fake because of this rise in AI. And so I think like using resources to talk about the ways that it can be used and why it's potentially harmful, I think is kind of the way forward on that piece.
Hi, I'm Ann Fisher. I was in journalism for about 40 years, including with Mike Thompson over there at WOSU. And I was listening to NPR the other day, a report about the lack of not just civic engagement, but civic education. Since post-World War II, we have put the focus on science and the STEMs and backed away from the humanities and civics education. And I'm not sure how you turn that around right now. Federal dollars, it's about 50 federal dollars per student in the country versus about 5 cents per student. $50 going for STEM education and about 5 cents per student going to civics education. So you can lead a horse to water, but can you make it drink? In other words, you can put all this great content out there, but nowadays, what have we lost in the mix here? And where do you think civics education or lack thereof plays a role in all of this?
My sister's in the audience, and we had this terrible civics teacher named Mr. Andres when we were in high school. And so this is not a new problem. Good, I'm glad he is. He was the worst. So this, you know, I mean, like it's been the case for a long time that there are bad teachers, you know, who are not teaching things well. I think civics is fraught in the moment because government itself is seen as something that's partisan and treated with partisan bias, and so I absolutely strongly would support that. I'm a data guy. I think we should have statistics classes in high school, honestly. I think that would introduce a rigor about understanding how things work and probabilities, which would be useful. I think there's a lot of education that should be done in a lot of different ways, and you know, to the extent that we can inject more of that to students in public schools, great, but you know, we should all be engaged in those sorts of self-education as well.
I think that's why you've seen the rise in investment in service journalism, where people are explaining everything from how to register to vote to how grand juries work. We really try to lean into that, and I know a lot of newsrooms are leaning into that because we learned when we were looking at like Google Trends, what are people searching for on election day? Where's my polling place? That's something that you think people would know, but they don't. And so how do we make sure that we're there for them when they're looking for those answers? And that, you know, that can be anything from how is education funded in Ohio? And it's not a dumbing down. It is bringing people in so that they understand how they can get civically involved.
Tariq, that's where I think TikTok does that. I mean, whether it's home repair or explaining complex issues, that's a real positive role that social media platform has had on our society.
Yeah, absolutely. TikTok and Instagram, I think, really like what you were mentioning, some of the things that people just don't know about civic engagement. I mean, if your last civics class was in high school and you haven't engaged since then people just don't know. And I think that's one of the special things about our show is that we talk about it as we're going on a learning journey with you because we don't know everything. And so we ask some very basic questions so that people can feel more empowered to get civically engaged and breaking that stuff down on social media, whether it's reels or, you know, people go into your stories and they understand how to register to vote. They understand what their city council does. They get to know the people who are on their city councils. Like, we do long form interviews with people that you really can't find anywhere else from our perspective. And I think that it's important. And I think that, you know, with the civic engagement piece, that's the only way that we're going to sort of find our way out of this is making people feel like they can get involved and that they have resources to do so and that they have a trusted neighbor that is providing them with those resources.
We have about 2 minutes left for a final question. This one comes from Alan Miller, and it really dovetails in nicely to this conversation. What will local news look like in 5 years? And how do we keep filling the gaps in communities where there are no news outlets?
I mean, for me, I think it goes back to that, how do we be conveners? How do we have the town halls, the panels, where we're interacting with people, that where it's not transactional? We're trying to build a lot of partnerships with other news organizations throughout the state, because we know we can't cover everything. And as newsrooms shrink, we got to kind of band together to help each other out. One of our goals is to reach into rural communities more and tell their stories. Because we know there's so many news deserts out there. So it is a resource issue, but if we work together, we may be able to get more covered to do that.
Surveys after surveys after surveys say that people want local news. Now, how you define local news can vary, but the thirst is out there. It's just to figure out a way to how to pay for it and how to make sure that we can provide that service that people really want. They want to know what's going on in their community, and hopefully we can continue to do that. I think that's going to wrap it up. Right, Sophia?
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, we explored the future of journalism and looked at how nonprofit and alternative media are building trust and amplifying local voices. We're grateful to this week's panelists: Philip Bump, author and former national columnist with the Washington Post; Michelle Everhart Sullivan, chief audience officer with Signal Ohio; and Taria Palmer, co-creator of the Columbus Can't Wait podcast. Our host was Mike Thompson, director of radio at WOSU Public Media. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. CMC's live stream partner was the Columbus Dispatch. This forum was sponsored by WOSU Public Media and was supported by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and by the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you're ready to learn more about this week's forum topic, our partners at the Columbus Metropolitan Library recommend reading What Works in Community News by Ellen Clegg and Dan Kennedy. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas to community conversations. I'm Doug Buchanan with CMC. Thanks for listening.